From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we hear what it could be like to have federal agents in Milwaukee. Then our Fit for You segment asks, even though gyms are open during the coronavirus pandemic, should you go?
Regardless of what the activity is, the gym in of itself, no matter the gym, is going to be a high risk area to go to.
We learn about the Milwaukee Independent Restaurant Coalition and what they hope to change in the hospitality industry.
You know, we knew that this was something that Milwaukee needed. We needed a voice for the independent restaurant and bars so that at the end of this, you know, we could see, the restaurant and bar community succeeding.
Plus, an epidemiologist gives her advice on how to protest safely in light of the coronavirus pandemic. Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The Trump administration announced last week that federal agents will be sent to Milwaukee in the coming weeks. This comes after Governor Tony Evers and the Milwaukee Police Department asked the administration not to send agents to the city. Milwaukee is one of several cities the administration is deploying agents to in an order to address violent crime. Right now, it's unclear how many federal agents will come to the city and what exactly they'll be doing here. The deployment of federal agents has come under scrutiny recently after their actions in Portland, Oregon. WUWM's Angelina Mosher-Salazar spoke with reporter Rebecca Ellis of Oregon Public Broadcasting to get a feel for what it's like to have federal agents in the city. Ellis was on the ground last week during protests in Portland and describes a particularly surreal scene involving the mayor of Portland, Ted Wheeler.
He went over to the federal courthouse where federal officers are inside guarding it. People will sort of go and throw things at the courthouse, and you don't quite know what's going to set the federal officers off. So I'm not sure what set them off, but by the time the mayor started going over there, something had set them off, and there was a ton of tear gas, CS gas, flashbangs. It was like it's been every night, but this time the mayor was front and center. And he said he experienced the tear gas for the first time. He and his staff were not super prepared. They didn't have tear gas they didn't have goggles or face masks, which a lot of experienced protesters at this point bring. So that happened twice. The mayor got gassed twice and then ended up leaving around midnight. But it was a very weird scene.
I just really want to get into your head at this point. Like, was that bizarre? Was that weird? Or has things been so kind of surreal that that didn't even really faze you?
The surrealness was the mayor being there. The gas is no longer surreal. Like, it is weird that I own a gas mask, right? And like, that's kind of part of my job now. But like, that aspect is no longer surreal. Like, I think so many protesters in Portland are, and comfortable is a weird word to use, but are very familiar with the gas and with being shot at with less lethal munitions and just the crowd control techniques these officers use. Because even before the federal officers got here, we had local police doing the same sorts of tactics, though slightly less extreme. So it's been nearly 2 months of this. So it's that aspect of gas and crowd control is not surreal. The mayor being part of it, very, very surreal.
Do you think this is going to result in a shift in public opinion on Twitter or on any other social media? Are you seeing kind of hot takes to what happened?
I've kind of seen like two parties. I think one I've seen on Twitter and I saw last night as it was yelled at the mayor is this is a photo op. We've been here for 50 days. Your own police force uses tear gas on us regularly. Get out, basically. Just like total skepticism and a lot of real, real anger at the mayor who controls the police force. But I also think there are people who thought that that was pretty brave to go into a crowd who he said last night he knows hates him. Not all of them, but a good number. And he stuck it out. I don't know if he was planning to stay that long. He didn't bring the tear gas mask or anything like that. But he stuck it out until midnight. He got gassed twice. So I think there were people who saw that and respected it.
Are there any inklings or are there any rumblings as to how the city will proceed forward in the coming days?
In terms of trying to get the federal officers out or?
Yes.
They will say any chance they get, they want these federal officers out. And they will also tell you they have jurisdiction anywhere in the United States. We're powerless, basically. I don't know that they'd use the word powerless, but they have no control. I know the mayor has said he's asked the city attorney to look into what, if anything, they can do to try and get these federal officers out of the city. Mm-hmm. There's work, I think, at the state level, and there's some lawsuits going. People are angry they're here. They want them out. I don't know that there's concrete steps that anyone knows that they can take to mm-hmm. get them out.
Okay. Could you give us a little bit of background as to how Portland got here?
We, like every other city, had large protests against police brutality and police violence. They started off massive like they did in other cities like New York, and they just kept going. They were often policed by our local police force. A lot of protesters would say pretty excessively, lots of tear gas. So that went on for, I mean, that was going on right until the federal officers got here.
And that was when?
My timeline is all messed up, but I think it was about 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
I think, yes, it was around July 4th weekend, and they were here. And it's been interesting watching the nation catch on and be like, what are they doing here? Because, yes, it was around July 4th. And we're all like, wait, why are federal officers here? And then it was once stories broke that they had shot a protester holding a boombox or a speaker in the head with a less lethal munition. And he had to get facial reconstruction surgery. And that made headlines nationally. And then, of course, the story about federal officers taking people off the streets and basically placing them in cars and asking them questions and dropping them off somewhere else. That story also made national headlines. And that's when the nation sort of caught on to the presence of federal officers here. But that had been happening for at least 2 weeks.
Wow. Well, Rebecca, I want to thank you so much for your time and for sharing with me what is happening in Portland. The reason that we were so eager to speak with you is because White House staff did mention that Milwaukee could be a city that is on a list that will also be seeing federal officers on the streets. You talked about Portland and how there has been consistent protests that were sparked after the death of George Floyd. And the same is true here in Milwaukee, where protesters have been marching daily and haven't stopped. So do you have any words or any insights to share to listeners who might be facing a similar situation?
Yeah. I mean, the biggest thing I think that we understand being here, but maybe it's not fully understood by other audiences, and even talking for my friends in other places, they don't fully understand. This is happening in maybe 2 or 3 block square radius in downtown Portland. And also it has happened by the police union in North Portland. But what I'm saying is it's very isolated pockets of the city that are very chaotic late at night and where federal officers are appearing with tear gas and less lethal munitions. It is not the entire city is not under siege, as the acting secretary of DHS has said. So I think that's just something important for your listeners to note. It's not that they're coming to occupy. If they do come, it's not that these federal officers are going to be showing up across the city, or at least that's really not how it's played out in Portland. It's been very isolated, small pockets of the city. The other thing I would just recommend, if for reporters out there covering this is it's not a sprint. It's a marathon. I mean, as I'm sure you know from covering the protests, I don't think this is ending anytime soon. So, yeah, just pace yourself.
Rebecca Ellis, news reporter at Oregon Public Broadcasting, thank you so much for your time and for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Rebecca Ellis is a reporter for Oregon Public Broadcasting. She spoke with WUWM's Angelina Moshe Salazar. Since the interview was recorded, the White House did confirm federal agents will be coming to Milwaukee. You can learn more about that at WUWM.com. Coming up next, our Fit for You segment looks at the risks of going to the gym during the coronavirus pandemic. This is Like Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Before the coronavirus pandemic, going to the gym wasn't just a way to stay physically healthy, but offered people a sense of accountability and community. During initial lockdowns, many of us found different ways to stay active, from virtual workouts to more outdoor activities. Now that some gyms are open again, should you go? Dr. Joyce Sanchez is an infectious disease specialist at Fratert and the Medical College of Wisconsin, and she joins me now to discuss where gyms fall in the risk of contracting or spreading COVID-19. Dr. Joyce Sanchez, welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you for speaking with me today.
Thank you for having me today.
So do you think that gyms overall should have been included as one of the first institutions allowed to reopen under the initial protocols that were across the United States when we were, quote, reopening?
Sure. I think a lot can be said about which facilities and which institutions should be prioritized for reopening. Certainly the facilities, the institutions that are more necessary, more essential, maybe not absolutely essential in the traditional sense as grocery stores and other things that sell things that people need, despite the lockdown and the pandemic early in the beginning. The gym, from my perspective, is a healthy thing to engage in, is also a luxury. And I think particularly early on when we were still understanding the role of airborne transmission, the role of droplet spread and close contact, gyms would not have been my first type of facility to open up.
And even under stricter sanitation protocols, can facilities where people congregate to sweat, to breathe heavily in confined spaces using shared equipment, you know, really be safe during the coronavirus pandemic?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer 100%, but let me start with what we know about the factors that primarily drive transmission and impact the risk of both acquiring COVID-19 and transmitting it to others. And that'll help us understand where gyms fall in that risk category. So first is time, second space, people and place. So time, space, people and place. Time being the less the time that you're in an area with other people, the better. Space is all about distance. So at least 6 feet or more, but the more the better. People, so the fewer amount of people that are in an area, the less the risk there is. And I would also include the behaviors that those people are engaging in, including whether or not they're wearing masks or facial coverings, and whether or not you and other individuals are properly washing or disinfecting hands. And the last piece is place. So indoor is going to be higher risk than outdoor types of activities. Air ventilation plays a factor. The humidity, the temperature, and the type of disinfection of the surfaces. So those are all things that gyms can address. But if we take all four factors into consideration, we can say without any question that not going to the gym is safer from a COVID-19 risk standpoint than going to the gym. So when you ask me the question, what can be done to truly make the gym a safe environment, making the facility risk-free is really not realistic expectation, short of having one's own private gym or using the gym services virtually, either via one-on-one instruction or group instruction. So while it can't be 100% and truly risk-free, there are things that gyms and gym goers can do to lower that risk by addressing those four factors.
There are no widespread protocols specific for gyms. It can vary from place to place and is based off of local, state, and county recommendations. But because when we go to a gym, we're exercising, and there are different levels of exercise, of course, and intensity. But in general, breath is being expelled more forcefully when we exercise. So you mentioned more distance is better, but should gyms have a different guideline that goes beyond the standard of 6 feet of distance recommendation? You know, should it be greater when it comes to not just moving around people, but spacing out equipment?
That's an excellent question. I wish I could answer that with any degree of absolute confidence. So 6 feet is the minimum recommended distance as dictated by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC. But you're absolutely right. When we talk about exercising where you're expelling air a little bit more forcefully, other activities like singing, forceful speech, coughing, sneezing, those all can expel droplets beyond 6 feet. We know that, and that doesn't even address the aerosolized particles, which are the small viral particles, which we don't know exactly how much that plays, but we believe that and know that there is some role for that too. So I can't tell you whether gyms need to enforce 8, 10, 12 feet between people or equipment, but certainly the greater the distance, the better. Now, that's only one thing that you can do in terms of space or distance to bring down the transmission of virus. So that's important. But gym goers themselves can actually instill practices that decrease the risk. So one example is wearing masks. And so if you wear your mask, you're at least cutting off that trail of droplets by many orders of magnitude. Studies have shown that cloth face coverings and masks have a significant impact on the distance that those droplets travel. So, but that not just one person, that needs to be everybody in the gym, or at least as many people as possible. And the second that gym goers can elect to do is to go during off-peak hours. So if you know that the gym is absolutely flooded at 7 a.m. or 6 a.m., try to avoid that. Maybe go midday or late in the evening to minimize the amount of time you're sharing that space with as other people are there. Wearing a mask can actually be a way to engage with other people in a meaningful way. And that may be a surprising statement, but think about it. A lot of people go to the gym to commune with other people, to be part of a team, a fitness, to hold each other accountable and to spur each other on. And people wear team t-shirts. Why not wear team masks? That's another tool. And studies shown time and time again that if you enter a room where everyone else is engaging in a behavior, guess what? You're much more likely to follow suit. So the same can be applied to wearing a mask. If you wear a mask and other people wear a mask, you're much more likely to encourage other people to say, hey, everyone else is doing this. I should probably do that too. So you yourself can set an example to others if you decide to go to a gym. And it's not an end all to decreasing transmission risk, but it's an additional layer you can add.
Right. And do you believe that this additional layer of wearing a mask, and especially because the mask requirements will vary from county to county, city to city, gym to gym, you know, and even though gyms have been putting in new ventilation system, they're upping their cleaning protocols and things of that nature. But, you know, unless you have a mask on, are all those other precautions, you know, it's not the end all be all. Do you think that it needs to be all of these factors at once? You can't really pick and choose.
Well, I think the more of those precautions you take, the better. Going to the gym is not going to be risk-free. So it's a matter of bringing down the risk in every way possible. And I think masks are playing a big role, even though they are not the only thing distance and being outdoors are probably bigger factors, although I can't quantify exactly how much engaging in those precautions is going to decrease that risk. But everything we can do in order to bring down the risk, the better. And I didn't even talk about whether or not outdoor exercise is a possibility. So, you know, gyms can offer fitness classes outside. Gyms may have capability to have virtual group fitness classes or one-on-one. You mentioned the ventilation systems can be adjusted in certain circumstances to avoid recirculating that same air. And then the diligence about wiping down equipment. But and those are all very, very important. But none of those things in of themselves or even together is going to completely stop transmission. So I get asked, you know, should I do this activity or that activity? And going to the gym is one of those questions. And I'm a medical doctor. I understand the importance of getting exercise. Absolutely. That's beneficial to one's health. There's no question that it is. And there are other benefits. It's a stress reliever for some people. It's a huge sanctuary from home. It's a place where you can find that community and motivation and make meaningful friendships and connections. So as people think about whether or not they decide to go to a gym, it's really important that they examine some factors. And one of the first is, what are their own health risks? So lots of gym goers have additional fat on their bodies, and obesity is a risk factor. If you get COVID-19, you're more likely to have a severe illness, diabetes, asthma, heart and lung disease, age. Those are all factors. And the more of those underlying health conditions you have, the more likely you may become severely ill. And we have to think outside of ourselves too. So what is the risk of those who we come into contact with? Because it's not just about ourselves. This virus is leaky and will find every vulnerable non-immune person to infect. It's very clever, and it's a virus like this is not one we've ever seen before in this lifetime. So those are two things someone has to examine before they engage in going to the gym. And the third is, what's the state of the pandemic locally? Are you in a state or in a district where cases are going up? Maybe that's not the time to go. Are things under really good control? Are cases going down? That is a factor that I think is very important to consider. And then lastly, what the risks of the actual activity are. So is this a gym class that can be taken outside? Is this a gym class that is in a large space where your distance at least 6 feet or more? Is this a gym that enforces mask wearing? And once you consider all those factors, yeah, everyone makes a choice. So it's also important, though, not to forget that if you're not comfortable going to that gym anymore after you go and see people aren't wearing masks, or maybe things aren't being disinfected properly, or there's not a large room where the space is larger, you can feel free to take your business elsewhere. In that case, you can take your exercise elsewhere if you feel uncomfortable with the situation. So you don't have to be locked in once you get there and you find, gosh, maybe this is not such a good idea.
Does warm, moist atmosphere, such as those found at a gym, you know, particularly if you're in a small group class studio that's separate from the bigger spaces, does that increase the rate of potential denser transmission with larger droplets? And is there any data or research that indicates sweat is at all a factor? And I know there's a lot we don't understand, but when it comes to things we, you know, do at the gym, which is sweat and breathe through our nose and our lungs different ways, how does that play into COVID transmission?
Sure. To date, I'm not aware of any COVID transmission going on through sweat. So this is a primarily respiratory virus, although it can invade the blood vessels and get into all of our end organs, including the liver, the brain, the kidneys. So it invades everywhere. But to my awareness, I haven't seen any studies that have specifically looked at whether live active virus that can be transmissible has been detected in sweat. However, does that really make a difference? Because we're talking about respiratory droplets being expelled and getting on skin and mixing with sweat. So I think from for all intents and purposes, the sweat question probably doesn't really matter when we talk about transmission, because it's really the droplet stuff. And when you're sweating, you're breathing heavy. So your risk is going to go up if you're sweating by virtue of that respiratory droplet expelling going on. As far as, you know, what's going to be higher risk, a closed gym with good fans, open windows, or a larger gym where they aren't unable to open windows, I don't know the answer to that. It's going to be a facility by facility basis. But regardless of what the activity is, the gym in of itself, no matter the gym, is going to be a high risk area to go to.
I'm not aware of any gyms that have done it here in Milwaukee or Wisconsin, but you do see pictures of gyms making little bubbles or pods for people. So I suppose depending on many things, and like, we will be affected long term, but I'm curious to see how gyms change in the long run.
Yeah, same here. I think people, and I commend people for being creative and thinking outside of the usual box. How can we keep people separate? I think those are all good things to think about. I also understand that gym owners and managers are, you know, financially in a place where they may be forced to open up because there's no other way of really providing for their families. And I understand that. So my message here is that my heart goes out to those people. My heart goes out to people who miss going to the gym. And I really wish I could say that this is a time where we've figured out how to make the risk low enough. Honestly, though, we're just not there yet.
Well, Dr. Joyce Sanchez, thank you for joining me and shedding a little bit of light on going to the gym during this pandemic.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Joyce Sanchez is an infectious disease specialist at Froedtert and the Medical College of Wisconsin. She joined me for this month's Fit for You segment, and you can explore all past segments at WUWM.com. Coming up next, we learn more about the Milwaukee Independent Restaurant Coalition. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The coronavirus pandemic has hit the hospitality industry hard. As COVID-19 rates continue to rise, restaurants have had to reevaluate their operating plans or permanently close. From the tipping system to sustainability to healthcare, this pandemic has exposed the major flaws of the hospitality system. The Milwaukee Independent Restaurant Coalition was recently formed to address these issues and create change so that restaurants can better succeed on the other side of this pandemic. Dan Jacobs of JVR Hospitality Group in Milwaukee has already had some of their restaurants close due to the pandemic. However, Jacobs sees hope for Milwaukee's restaurant economy if independent restaurants can unite. That's why he co-founded the MIRC, and Jacobs joins me now to tell us what inspired the action.
We needed to do something. We needed to organize. And I think at first it was just so we could kind of all get together and have the same phone call, you know, or have the same, just put everything in the same thread. And then we're like, you know, let's form a coalition. I think, you know, it's going to be better for us to voice our concerns as one loud voice, as opposed to a bunch of unorganized little voices. I have no experience, neither does John really, in coalition forming. Which, you know, is good and bad, but, you know, we knew that this was something that Milwaukee needed. We needed a voice for the independent restaurant and bars so that at the end of this, you know, we could see, you know, the restaurant and bar community succeeding.
So this was formed during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was formed in response to, so it was real early April. You know, we kind of idled around with what our mission was going to be. The first thing we did was we raised money for Caitlin Cullen to do the community meals for people who were out of work. We raised $25,000, you know, and then we kind of just idled and didn't really know what our purpose was. I got involved with the Independent Restaurant Coalition at the national level and started to realize that, you know, our voice was we could use our voice to help the Independent Restaurant Coalition and independent restaurants at large affect change. And one of the biggest things, you know, that the Restaurant Coalition has been working on is the Restaurant Stabilization or the Restaurant Act, which would inject $120 billion into independently owned restaurants to really just help restaurants get through this. You know, the PPP is nice, but it doesn't really work real well for restaurants and bars. You know, using 60% of it on your payroll when you're not bringing anybody in or doing anything doesn't make sense. You know, and I think most of us, especially restaurants, are uniquely vulnerable in a way that, you know, we don't want to settle ourselves with a bunch of extra debt. So we wanted to, you know, really kind of put forward something where we could help independent restaurants, help people get through COVID-19 without incurring a ton of debt, and be able to have that flexibility to not just pay rent, mortgage, taxes on our mortgage and our employees, but to, you know, pay our vendors as well, because, you know, restaurants are an engine of a economic ecosystem, you know, of a local economy. Our reach is so far and varied that, you know, most people don't realize the extent of the things that we touch, whether it's local farmers, local cheesemakers, you know, to large broadliners that employ truck drivers and, you know, factory workers, and to linen companies, you know, that not only do their part, you know, locally, like we use Baytel out of Green Bay, but they also use a local fabric maker that makes their aprons and stuff like that. But without restaurants, that fabric maker is not going to have anything to do. So it's really one of those things that we saw a real need and something that could, you know, just stimulate the economy right away. We also act as a pass-through for money. I mean, the way you look at it is, you know, 90 to 95 cents of every dollar that comes into a restaurant goes directly out of that restaurant into the community, whether it's, like I said, paying vendors or paying our employees. And our employees then go and spend money in the community as well. So we just saw this as a really great way to kind of A, stimulate the economy, and B, really save kind of restaurants as, you know, the gatekeepers, you know, for culture in a community. Restaurants are important. Not only are they gathering places historically for information and for celebrations, but they truly, you know, give you insight into a community.
The MIRC also supports fair, more economically sustainable, and more inclusive restaurant and bar communities. So what does inclusivity mean to you?
The term inclusivity should be something that we all should be thinking about, not just me. This is something that we all are kind of, at least I am, I'm introspectively thinking about this. Me and Dan have had long conversations about this. And for years, we've wanted to find a way to really change pieces of the restaurant industry that could really affect inclusivity. And one of them being is the tipping policy. Tipping is inherently racist. It is a practice that, you know, ever since, you know, we were opening up Dan Dan, which is like literally in 2 weeks, it'll be 4 years ago, we wanted to do this. But the status quo was what it was, and it would have made it very difficult. Right now, we have a blank slate. Like the restaurant industry as a whole, not just tipping, but how we look at who works in the front, who works in the back, how we promote people, how we hire people, how owners can get a more equitable share of, you know, of the restaurant itself is all on the table, I think. And one of the ways that we can really help employees out right now is to just do away with the tipping policy, which we've done at Dan Dan, and we've done it successfully for the last 4 weeks. We moved to a service fee-based system. We automatically tack on 20% to every bill. This is used to pay the entire staff. So it breaks down, you know, everybody makes a salary. Everybody makes way above a minimum wage. It can be done. And we're not blowing money. The only thing that, you know, we lose is we lose the tip tax credit, which, you know, is in place to basically keep this system in place. And it's up to us to try and find a way to change that and break that.
Yeah, among tipping and the way that is used as the main way for people to get and earn money in the restaurant industry, you know, COVID is also exposing a lot of other faulty systems and a lack of longevity, you know, such as how difficult it is to get health insurance for yourself as restaurant owners or for your workers, benefits, other things like that. So You mentioned you're able to do this successfully at Dan Dan. Do you think there is enough reception across the industry to, as you said, really make new changes with this blank slate you'll have?
I've been on conversations in groups with HUA, which is a Hospitality United organization, and then in the Independent Restaurant Coalition about this very thing. And I think there's enough interest and there's enough of us that really see this as a opportunity to seize. I think our biggest mistake that we could make is to let this opportunity pass us by and just go back to the status quo. Because the status quo wasn't working great before. It was there, but we can make this better. We can do better. And it's up to us to do that.
Back in June, the MIRC also called upon the city to require face masks when in restaurants and other public places. And that order is now in effect here in Milwaukee. But when it comes to the ebb and flow of restaurants trying to balance and weigh the risks of operating at different capacities, or in some cases, opening, closing, reopening, closing again, or like you said, closing permanently, how do you think this highlights these issues of sustainability in the field of hospitality?
I'm going to be real, real frank. It sucks. You know, it's incredibly difficult to play this balancing act. The main reason why we asked the city for the mask mandate is we have enough on our plate. I don't need to argue with somebody about the merits of wearing a mask. At the very baseline of why a mask is important is it just shows how much you care about the people around you. If you're truly a Christian, if you're truly just a good person, you're interested in the health of the people around you and just keeping the people around you safe. This is the easiest thing we could do without going backwards to a stay-at-home order. It's the only way that we will keep our staff safe, our business safe, and be able to continue operating is for our guests to wear masks along with us. It's the right thing. It was the right move. It should have been done a lot earlier. As far as, you know, weighing the options of what to do, I mean, it's incredibly difficult. You know, we at Dan Dan have only opened our patio. We allow people to come inside just to place their order or to use the bathroom. We have a counter service now where we give numbers to tables. We run the food out to them. We give them the drinks as they walk out. And I don't know if I'm comfortable having diners inside right now. I mean, it's tough. I mean, I'm watching my friends around me close their restaurants temporarily. We closed Fauntleroy permanently because it became too difficult for us to operate at the standard that we hold ourselves to. When you don't have a way to have people inside, it's very difficult to be able to effectively do anything. Nothing is successful right now. If anything, we're all scraping by, purely just based on numbers. You know, it became something that we knew we had to do, regardless of it being a hard decision. And it's incredibly hard, man. I mean, you're talking about telling people that have been with us for, 4 years that, you know, I'm sorry, but I'm going to lay you off now. And I don't think I'm going to be able to bring you back. And that's difficult. Not only the starting and stopping. So if you do have a staff member that tests positive, you know, the right thing to do is to shut completely down, which is what I'm watching my friends do. And then, you know, what do you do with the product? You know, what do you do with, you just have to start all over again. So this, I don't think people realize it's not like snapping a finger and I can just get right back. My restaurant's just going to reopen. It takes staff. It takes product. Like, you have to redo everything. You know, it's incredibly difficult, and I'm terrified of wintertime. I have no idea what's going to happen come October, because once we can't use this patio, I don't know, man. I just don't know.
You've mentioned that coming together on a united front through this coalition helps you bring all of your voices to one front. So as we tentatively move through this time of the coronavirus, what do you think are the main legislative and ethical issues you believe that the MIRC can help with, or that the restaurant industry faces overall?
Right now, I think in the short term, you know, the restaurant industry needs help. It needs Congress to throw us a bone. Congress has bailed out other industries where it was their fault, whether it was the banking industry in 2008, multiple times the automobile industry, or the airline industry, they were bailed out by the federal government, and that was brought on by decisions that they made. Unlike any of these things, independent restaurants and restaurants in general face a absolute crisis, but we didn't do this to ourselves. We were all doing pretty well in February, and then all of a sudden, it was like a steep decline off a cliff come middle of March. And really, like, you know, success is now based on, man, I'm doing 50% of my sales. That's success right now. You know, and that's a tough pill to swallow, which is why we're asking, you know, the federal government for help. You know, short term locally, you know, it would be real helpful if the state of Wisconsin can get together legislatively and give us a temporary pass on allowing cocktails to be sold to go or open containers to be sold to go. One of the things that, you know, if you're a restaurant and you don't have a patio or, you know, you're unwilling to let people inside your restaurant, is you miss out on 30% of your sales right there with liquor, beer, wine. So allowing us to be able to sell that stuff to customers on their way out the door, sealed in a safe way, would go a long way towards helping restaurants be more viable and stay viable for a longer period of time. That would be an absolute help to everybody. But again, you know, Wisconsin's liquor laws are incredibly old, incredibly hard to change, and go along a very, very divided line between political parties. And it's unfair for people like myself or, you know, even the, you know, the local little bars like Bernhardt's, Newport, Mothership, and Bayview to have to, you know, they can't do what they should be able to do because, you know, guys are arguing about something that, you know, has nothing to do with them. It's just about helping us out right now.
Well, Daniel Jacobs, I want to thank you for your time and helping to shed light on some of the issues you're personally facing.
Thank you so much. I mean, we're just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, if the government doesn't help us out in some sort of a way, you know, we're looking at 1 in 4 restaurants closing, and that's a real, real thing.
Dan Jacobs is the co-founder of the Milwaukee Independent Restaurant Coalition. We'll take one last break, then hear tips on how to stay safe while protesting during a pandemic. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. More of Lake Effect now, I'm Audrey Nowakowski. A protest requires a group of people to gather together. And activists in Milwaukee have made it clear they're not stopping anytime soon. There's chanting, singing, and shouting in protest of police brutality, and with each word, they're spreading minuscule water droplets into the air. That's a problem. COVID-19 cases are spiking in Wisconsin. While people are gathering and protesting, we're still in the middle of a global pandemic. So how can people demonstrate while maintaining their safety? Dr. Laura Cassidy is the research director for the Institute for Health and Equity at the Medical College of Wisconsin. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers in June about the health concerns associated with these demonstrations. She has these tips on how to stay safe while protesting.
So my first question is a pretty simple one. When you're looking at these protests here in Milwaukee, what are your initial concerns regarding this pandemic?
My initial reactions are that the virus is still out there. And we've done a good job of containing it. We've all been so responsible and have protected each other and looked out for each other. But it's still there. And we know it passes from person to person. That's the only way it can be transmitted. So at first, I do feel a little bit of concern. And when we gather in crowds, it can pass faster. People are not always 6 feet apart. And a lot of people wore masks, but a lot of people didn't. And we need to make sure they wear them correctly. So my first concern was about the disease being transmitted from person to person.
Yeah. And of course, you know, I was at one of the marches. People were, most of them were wearing masks, but a lot of people are not 6 feet apart, people are in some cases shoulder to shoulder. When it comes to wearing masks, staying far apart, how good are these things at controlling the spread when you're already in a large group like this?
Right. So staying apart and wearing masks and washing our hands are some of the few ways we have to really control the virus. The good news is people were outside, so that's better than being inside. And they were wearing masks, which helps protect other people, but it doesn't protect you 100%. The other thing is when they're protesting, you're yelling, you're singing, you're chanting, and that causes the droplets to go farther. So that was a concern as well. And also people tend to put their masks on and off to talk or touch their face because of the mask, and that can actually promote spreading.
So what are some of the tips that you have for people who are walking in the protest, especially to make sure that they're staying as safe as possible while demonstrating?
Right. That's a really good question, because doing this safely is so important right now because it could affect our more vulnerable populations in the long run. So when you're walking, you know, put your arms out at arm length and try and make sure there's at least both arm lengths away from everybody. At least you're going in one direction, so you're not face to face. Wear your masks and bring hand sanitizer.
You know, I've seen a lot more cars trailing the protests than what I normally see. You know, they have signs, sometimes they have supplies for people. Is that a safer way to protest in a vehicle like that?
Well, it might be safer as far as transmitting disease, and if they're good drivers and they don't get in a car accident, of course, and wear seatbelts. I am an epidemiologist. However, if people are packing into cars and not wearing masks, then they're in a confined space where they could infect each other.
Okay. As far as supplies go, you know, we've seen a lot of people who are handing out water and things. I'm not sure if everybody is taking the kind of precaution of washing off things as they hand them to one another or start taking sips from things. How big is the risk of getting COVID-19 from touching something that somebody else who might be infected has touched?
Well, we do know now that the primary mode of transmission is person to person through droplets. However, you know, the virus can live on objects for a certain amount of time. So if somebody were infected with the virus and perhaps did not know they had it and were asymptomatic and sneezed or coughed or yelled and got droplets on the bottle, there is potential that if the next person took that bottle and touched their face, they could get infected.
But it's less of a concern than the person-to-person contact?
I think it's less likely, but it's still a concern.
Okay. So this is something we actually talked a bit about before the interview began. Police have been throwing tear gas canisters at people, and there's been a concern among some health professionals that this is increasing the chances of contracting coronavirus. Do you know why that would be?
You know, that's a really great question, and I don't think right now there's any data on it or research on it. But just if you think about it logically, if tear gas is being thrown, probably the first reaction is to wipe your eyes, perhaps to remove your mask or move it around. And it also creates chaos where people might bump into each other. They might touch each other more. They may be running. And also, I don't know the effect of the tear gas on the lungs and if it would make people more likely to get ill.
But certainly they'd be more likely to start coughing up.
Yes, I do believe you're right about that.
So we had been talking a lot about contact tracing, something that we've wanted to start more of to really understand how this disease is spreading. But right now we have a situation where there are thousands of people gathering in cities around the country. How could that impact contact tracing?
Yes. So this is a unique situation where we have a pandemic and we have crowds assembling. And if you look at a lot of the outbreaks across the country, they're due to crowding. New York City, people live so close together. Nursing homes, meatpacking plants. So this is an area where people are crowding, and they may not know the people around them that they could be spreading the disease to or getting it from. So this is going to make it very challenging. And I think one of the keys is if you've been at one of these protests and you know of somebody who has tested positive for COVID, then please be proactive. Go get tested, self-quarantine till you get the results. If you're feeling any symptoms, get tested and self-quarantine so that we don't continue to spread it. And do the best you can to report it and help with the contact tracing. But when you don't know, when you've been in a big crowd, you don't know the people you've been in contact with. I think, you know, if people are willing to share that they have been at the protest, that might help in some way.
Would you advise people who have been a part of these demonstrations to go get checked?
Yes, I think so. Generally, if you have symptoms or you've been in contact with somebody who has symptoms, you should get checked. But there is a lot of free testing out there. The thing to consider is the period between exposure and onset of symptoms. So if you were there yesterday and you go get a test today, it may not come up positive, but it might in a couple days. So, you know, there's a balancing act there where you may be carrying it and transmitting it and not knowing you have it, between that and being tested too soon.
Was there anything that I didn't ask you about that you thought I would?
I think, you know, something that has been worrying me that I've heard a lot from people is that because businesses are reopening and we're not at shelter in place anymore, that it's okay, we're safe, we can go out. And the reason that we are okay to go out and the virus, we've slowed the spread so much, is because of all of our individual behaviors in practicing good hygiene, distancing, you know, face coverings. And so I don't want that to stop. You know, we can continue through this if we do it together.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Cassidy, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
And thank you so much. And, you know, I think this is a really important time in our lives, and I encourage people to be as safe as possible about this. And it's our responsibility, each one of us, to try to control this virus in these times.
Dr. Laura Cassidy is the research director for the Institute for Health and Equity at the Medical College of Wisconsin and the director of the PhD program in Public and Community Health and the Division of Epidemiology. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers last month. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.